This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Hello and welcome to Word for Word. Dean Beck and Joy Etwell are with you today. Now, Australia was once a country that embraced those who needed a home. In 1951, the United Nations formed a commission for refugees, and Australia proudly signed that agreement to assist some 1.5 million people around the world who needed a new land to live in. Today, nearly 50 million people are displaced, and about half of those are displaced because of natural disasters. Now, in the 50s and 60s, we welcomed the Italians and Greeks. In the early 70s, we welcomed those from Southeast Asia. And then something changed, and from mid to late 90s, Australia was no longer a land that seemed happy to welcome those from other nations in need. Well, joining us today is a lady who has spent a lifetime looking after those in need and who have landed on our shores and need help. Her name is Kez Coleman. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Kez, let's go right back to the start. How on earth did you get involved in working with refugees?
After finishing my study, I decided I needed to get out in the world. So went and did some volunteer work. Started off in Indonesia, but then moved on to India. And that placement was with Sri Lankan Tamils who had fled across from Sri Lanka to Tamil Nadu, that short stretch of water, and were living in refugee camps. Hundreds of thousands of them. And the organisation I volunteered with was a remarkable one in a unique situation where they were self-managing. So the UNHCR wasn't involved in the camp, and it just opened my eyes to the challenges but also the possibilities of caring for people who are seeking asylum.
So what sort of things did you do there?
Well, I think they taught me more than what I ever gave back. But at the time, I was looking at international grants for the organisation, looking to seek some money for them so that they could continue the programs that they were delivering in the refugee camps.
Kaz, why does it matter where people come from?
Well, it shouldn't matter where people come from. And I think one of the challenges we have at the moment is we keep talking about a solution to the refugee problem, and really there is only one solution, and that would be to stop every conflict in the world, any government that is persecuting its people.
From our angle, I'd like to see the language change and call it an opportunity.
That's
for
right.
us to do what we've done previously and learn and grow and mould and enjoy the difference that those other nations have brought to our country. And like I said in the intro, something changed. Sure, there were always people that weren't happy with the WOGs or the Vietnamese or whatever, but somehow those people became vocal in the 90s, and it's gone downhill fast.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of challenges that are actually particular to Australia in lots of ways, because we're surrounded by water, so it's quite hard to get to Australia. And I think that the attention that's been placed on boat arrivals in particular, because keeping in mind, traditionally most people come and seek asylum by plane. They're living in the community. There's 8,000 to 10,000 of them at the moment, and we don't seem to create a fuss about that. So there was a real, I think, spotlight placed on boat arrivals, around those myths about the queue and people coming in irregular ways. And
jumping the queue.
That's right. And detention doesn't help that situation where we place large numbers of people in facilities. And it's very easy to look at that and create comment about that, whereas what we know is when people are living in the community, they just get on with it, and so do we.
I find it extraordinary that it's taken till this week for us to realise that putting children into detention centres is probably not the best thing.
It's really disappointing, although I have to say that the program has been working since last October when the Minister announced it, and there's been an enormous and fantastic effort put in by the Australian Red Cross and other NGOs. But you're absolutely right. The problem is that we keep having this discussion about how long is too long for children to be in detention, when actually the discussion should be, well, we don't want children in detention. We know that it harms them. And the only way really to stop that roundabout question is to legislate care arrangements for children in the community.
I think the whole word detention sort of says that they've done something wrong. And that maybe we need to start by getting away from that and calling it something else.
Yeah, look, you're absolutely right. And of course, you know, again, a lot of those myths around people being illegal is completely wrong. They may have arrived in an unauthorised way, but as soon as they ask for protection in Australia, they have a legal status. They're lawfully here and going through their process. So other countries around the world call them reception centres or reception arrangements. But of course, that often looks like going straight into the community, receiving asylum seekers with hospitality.
Now, let's get a few words clarified. What is a displaced person as opposed to a refugee or an asylum seeker?
Yeah, it's a good question. A refugee is technically someone who has, if you like, passed the test under the Refugee Convention in terms of establishing persecution for a range of reasons.
Now, our government's preference would be that they pass that test in another country before they get here.
Well, we have two programs. One is that we take refugees who've passed that test from refugee camps around the world, and we're one of the top three countries that do that, amazingly, in the world. There's not many programs, mostly because people flow across borders in such great numbers.
Other countries. Emergency situations.
That's right. Yeah. So that's one of the ways. And then the other way is that we have people arriving either by plane or by boat who are asylum seekers.
Right. So back to those definitions. Mm. A displaced person and an asylum seeker is a...
I'll start with the asylum seeker. Yeah. It's someone who is, if you like, has applied to be tested under the Refugee Convention.
Right.
So they're not yet designated a refugee. They're waiting for that answer. And a displaced person could be someone who's displaced within their own country. So, for instance, conflicts swept through their village and they've been forced to flee to another place within the country. So they're displaced from their home, if you like. Or it may be someone who's come across a border into another country. But generally, the UNHCR would use the word refugee in that circumstances. The difference is whether they want to go home or not.
Is the reason that the people are put in detention because they don't have papers?
They don't have a legal status in terms of the way they arrived. So we don't yet know who they are. But of course, other countries don't do that when people arrive.
How do they handle it?
Well, for instance, the UK has a different system. In fact, most countries have a different system. We have mandatory detention. They use it in more of a risk assessment way, which basically means they interview the person, they look at their circumstances, and they assess whether they're a risk to the community. If they assess that they're not, then they allow them to go into the community. And in particular, in the UK, they provide housing, financial aid, and support services whilst they're waiting for their application to be processed. Canada does a similar thing. They have reception centres. And then, in fact, in Canada, people will apply for what our equivalent is of Centrelink. Sweden, similar. All three of those countries use detention in limited ways for those who they may see as a security threat.
So why do the people that bring these people to our shores, why do they insist on destroying their papers?
People often say that it's the smuggler who will either take their papers, and they're often too scared to argue. They're very much in a vulnerable position. Other people say that the people smuggler tells them to destroy them because it will help their chances. There's a range of reasons, but of course, vulnerable people in that circumstance will often listen to the person that they see is holding their life in their hands.
And they see that person as doing them a favour. Or a specialist travel agent, or at least giving you the one way out of your dire situation.
That's right. As long as people don't feel safe where they are, don't have the conditions to keep them safe, then they will continue to move. And really going back to that issue around, you know, what's the solution? Well, if we can't stop conflict, people will inevitably flee And so what we need to do is see it as a management of an inevitable result of conflict, and managing asylum arrangements or travel needs to be made up of a whole range of things. There's not just one answer to the management of asylum seekers.
I grew up with refugees in my home all the time. My mother harboured Vietnamese illegal boat refugees throughout the 70s and took them from safe house to safe house with the support of various NGOs, well, they weren't called NGOs back then, churches and places that would prepare to assist, and got the kids into schools, got them clothed, got them dressed. Those kids are now doctors, real estate agents, university graduates, and contributing to our society. Those people who arrived have worked their butts off since the day they arrived to contribute to the country and to make their lives better. Is there any evidence that that type of situation doesn't happen with the new arrivals?
Well, there's probably two points I'd make on that, and one is that you're absolutely right, and in fact a great piece of research that's just been released by Professor Graham Hugo looked at the 750,000 refugees we've had since World War II and showed that they have provided an enormous contribution to Australia, and with fantastic results. I guess the challenge for us is that often people need a bit of time to settle in a country, so we may not see that contribution straight away, although in some ways we do with volunteering. The challenge for us is that when we put someone in a detention centre for extended periods of time, they develop physical or mental health issues. That possibility for them to contribute becomes much longer and less likely.
And I would argue that they arrive with physical and mental health issues because of where they've come from.
That's right. In many cases, they do. And if we're talking about, you know, the future settlement in Australia, and let's bear in mind that at the moment, the success rate for people arriving by boat is 70%. So we have 70% of that population in detention for long periods of time. They're going to be future Australians. And what happens is that when they come out of a detention centre, and the settlement services are telling us this, they're less able to do basic things in life compared to those who either come straight from another country or only spend a short period of time in detention. In some ways, we're shooting ourselves in the foot by not allowing that contribution and allowing people's health and welfare to be a part of our society.
It costs us more money, surely.
That's right.
So what do they do? I've never been to a detention centre, and I'm sure most people haven't. What do they do there? Do they just sit around, or do they try and teach them English? Do they do something constructive?
There are a number of programs within a detention environment that that the contractor Serco, who the government has contracted, is required to do, and that's about duty of care. It's about making sure that they have English classes, that they're well fed, that they have some recreational activities. But let's be honest and say that, you know, those environments are very challenging for people, and very challenging for people who have had many times traumatic experiences. It can be hard to motivate people to engage in those activities. It's a bit like a chicken and an egg. And the longer they remain in detention, what we see is the less likely they're willing to engage in those sorts of activities.
Well, it must absolutely destroy their self-esteem.
Well, there's many documented research pieces that are showing that the length of time in detention is directly related to a demise in mental health.
The situations that people come from are unique to each land, and particularly with some of the Somalian refugees that have arrived to our country, I believe that there is a disconnect, if you like, with armed forces. They don't see the police, for example, as being people you can trust and go to. They're people you run from and flee from. How difficult is it to change that type of cultural issue, I guess?
In many cases, people are very afraid of authority, not just police officers, but anyone in authority because of those reasons. Absolutely. And it is a challenge to reorientate people to feeling safe, and not only within their home, but within the environment. And that's the Australian context and how we do things here.
Because for many of those lands, anyone that had authority was corrupt.
Well, it's directly related to why they've got refugee status.
Yeah, sure.
The state can't protect them or is involved in persecuting them. So it's inevitable in lots of circumstances that they feel that way. But again, the healthier someone is, the better able they are to actually take on those new environments. When people have been damaged, and I would suggest that we're actually damaging them more than when they first arrived, there's a huge challenge around settlement there.
Now, in 2009, 8,427 people sought asylum here in Australia. During that year, more than 45,000 people landed in the UK, more than 38,000 in the USA, and nearly 34,000 in Canada. So we're a fraction of any of that, and we have a massive space of land. You look at how small the UK is. They got 45,000 people that year.
That's right. In fact, I mentioned I had the opportunity to do some research in the UK, Canada and Sweden. And when I was there, and I mentioned this the other day when I was talking with Joy, that we were looking at why those countries provide community-based care for people who arrive and don't put them in detention. I asked one of the UK senior border officials why they provide these services, and he looked at me like I was slightly mad and said, well, it's a human rights issue, and besides, we couldn't possibly afford to detain them all. Absolutely. And I think the difference there,
maybe we just need more.
Well, I think the difference there is that he's right, they couldn't afford to, but they also have domestic legislation that requires them to care for asylum seekers within a community setting unless there's a security issue.
Requires them to treat humans like humans.
That's right.
We're speaking with Kaz Coleman, and she is a member of the Council for Immigration. She advises the political powers at be, Chris Bowen, Honourable Chris Bowen, who is the Minister for Immigration, on issues pertaining to that. Let's talk about some of the so-called solutions to this so-called problem that we have. Nauru. Now, there's not a lot there, but there is a purpose-built facility for processing asylum seekers. Why is it that we've just thrown that sideways and we're now looking at Malaysia, of all places, one of the most racist countries on the planet, and not renowned for their immigration policies? Why are we jumping into bed with them?
Well, the UNHCR would distinguish a difference between what they call burden sharing and burden shifting. And basically, burden shifting means coming up with a solution for a group of people, asylum seekers, so that we don't have to deal with it. Now, essentially, Nauru, Manus Island, any engagement with those countries really is only shifting asylum seekers that arrive on Australia into that country for the purpose of processing.
It's all of this because the minute they land on our shores, they have to be processed differently. Or their status is different.
Certainly compared to someone who arrives with papers or with documentation. But really, the so-called solution for Nauru is really just avoiding having to process people in Australia. There's no impact for what is the regional challenge of asylum movement. Now, going to countries like Malaysia or Indonesia or Thailand to have discussions actually engages countries who host most of the asylum seekers in our region. Indonesia.
So they're getting them anyway, is what you're saying.
Indonesia has 17,000, Malaysia has 92,000, Thailand has hundreds of thousands.
Every year.
Every year. And so really what we want to be doing, if we want to make our region to have a better way of receiving asylum seekers or managing them, is to talk to those countries who also have arrivals. One of the challenges in the world is that not everyone's going to get a settlement place. There are only 100,000 settlement places for 15.4 million refugees.
Oh, now,
that's
good odds.
1%, less than 1%.
That's right. You're absolutely right. So one of the things we need to look at is, okay, if we can't resettle everybody, what are the other options? And I mentioned earlier that people will continue to leave a location if they don't feel safe and if they don't feel they have a realistic option to actually care for themselves.
Yeah.
That's right. So talking to countries like Malaysia, Indonesia, Thailand, is looking at ways, what the UNHCR calls durable solutions. But it basically means, well, how do we keep people safe where they are? And if they're not safe where they are, how do we come up with a solution so that we can move them to a resettlement location? Now, there are lots of issues, and certainly in the media, you know, there's been lots of debate around discussions with Malaysia. But the reality is we don't actually even know yet what that looks like. You know, the UNHCR has indicated they're pushing hard on their five protection principles, and we haven't heard from them yet what they think about the arrangement. We don't actually know yet what we're debating.
Last week, the ABC reported that the Honourable Chris Bowen was only given a front bench ministry if he accepted the immigration portfolio. Here is a man who clearly didn't want the job, but accepted it because he wanted to be on the front bench. Out of 10, what do you rate his current efforts?
I've been really impressed with Minister Bowen in the sense that he has shown a great deal of interest and compassion for particularly for the children, and achieving that outcome of majority of children out of detention has been a great outcome.
But has it been totally ineffectual? One minute it's East Timor, then it's maybe Papua New Guinea, then it's suddenly Malaysia. I mean, who's running the show and how much has he achieved?
Well, I think it's a good question that it doesn't come down to one person, and I think we really need to look at government policy across the board. There are a number of things that they could be doing that they're not doing. And I'd have to say, whilst I am on the council advising the Minister for Immigration, he doesn't have to accept our advice.
Indeed.
So I could talk about a range of strategies I think would work.
But what you do have to do is be politically strategic, and I accept that.
With this whole area, though, I wonder if the government is trying to put stuff out there because everyone's crying out for some answers, rather than actually working out what the best solutions, notice I said more than one, so they put all this stuff out there, having actually not made a decision on stuff like Malaysia.
I think one of the big challenges we've got here is the political context of this debate. I think there has been a lack of leadership on this issue by the current government, but I also think there's been some appalling debate from the opposition as well. And I think we all as individuals have to also look at our role within that. You know, as citizens, what do we think about the policies that are being implemented? What do we think about the opposition's policies? And really, this debate wouldn't exist if a whole group of people said, come on, we want leadership, we want better solutions.
It's a long way from the days of Malcolm Fraser leading a Conservative government, welcoming those in need.
Well, I think there's been a lack of leadership on this issue for a long time. And the reality is that this is a long-term issue. As we've already talked about, there's not a quick fix solution to it. So any government into the future for the next 10, 15, 20 years is going to need to come up with or at least deal with this challenge within the region. The irony is that without some positive bipartisan principles on that, we're just going to keep yo-yoing between centres in different places and strategies with our counterparts in the region.
I think it's awful that the politicians are using people's lives to play politics. And we look at John Howard and the Children Overboard situation where he made all these claims that were false just before an election to get people afraid of what might happen with all these people coming in by boat and to vote for them.
It is very sad, Joy, and I think you've nailed it on the head there in the sense that we are talking about human beings. But often when we see debate in the media or by politicians and even by individuals, we seem to have lost that core element, people's lives and basic human rights. And we need to bring that back into this discussion.
And yet we're looking at now, and I don't know if this is still the case, we're going to swap 800 from here to get 4,000 from there with Malaysia. So we're still playing with people's lives. We'll give you 800 and you give us 4,000.
To a large degree, I think it's unfortunate that we have to move anyone from Australia. But again, you want to talk about political pragmatism. And increasing the resettlement quota is fantastic. Relocating people onto different shores is challenging.
But why can't we say we're going to take 3,200?
But hang on a minute. We've got an entire immigration department that is set up to process these people. Why, firstly, do we need another country to do that processing? And secondly, does it take up to or more than 2 years to process somebody? There needs some asses to be kicked in that department, no doubt.
I think there are some significant challenges with the time of processing.
It's ridiculous.
I think one of our challenges is that we have different organisations under the one government dealing with different aspects of it. So you've got one organisation dealing with security, one issue, one organisation dealing with processing, and really there needs to be some better, organised commitment to getting those timeframes down. That's right.
It's extraordinary. Now, over the last 10 years, there's been some 13,000 places granted under Australia's humanitarian program. What does that mean?
Basically, that program is our whole program in terms of refugees and asylum seekers.
That's our official immigration refugee policy.
That's right. So it's been in place for a long time. There's a great argument that it should be increased.
How many have we currently got in detention?
Just under 5,000, I believe.
So more than a third of that.
That's right. The problem for us is that this government and previous governments link those two aspects. So when we take people from refugee camps from around the world, that number is directly linked to how many arrive by boat. So the more who arrive by boat, the less we can take from camps.
Is arrival by boat unique to Australia / this region?
Oh, certainly not. I mean, I think we've seen...
Does it happen in the UK? Does it happen in the US? Do they arrive by boat there?
Well, certainly Canada had, a recent arrival, and there's boat arrivals basically all around the world. It depends what your country looks like. Most countries
have... And how close it is to another.
That's right. And but most countries would have a flow across their borders because... they actually have a border with another country.
Well, look at the United States and Mexico. How many come from Mexico to try and escape what's going on there?
That's right. And the challenge they will have is people being hidden in vehicles and then, of course, the conditions for them and unfortunately people do die. And I think that's part of what we need to get back to is the reason we don't want people to come on a boat is because they're risking their lives.
Well, look at what happened at Christmas Island.
That's right.
Now, jargon is swamping this particular debate. Boat people is just one of the jingoistic terms. How do you feel about that language as opposed to distressed people in need that need our help? I mean, that's what we're talking about.
Yeah, and there's no doubt that language contributes to the polarisation on this issue. Things like boat people, queue jumpers, illegals, all of which are actually technically wrong. So anybody using them, I think it really needs to take a serious think about the way they're influencing the general public with technically incorrect words for the purposes of their own political gain.
Kaz Coleman is with us and we're talking about the refugee situation. And Kaz is an advisor to the Minister for Immigration. Now, Kaz, the Australian mindset seems to have shifted in the last 20 years or so. Why is it that we have become this unempathetic nation of racists?
I think there's a range of reasons. And, the shift in debate, I think, has been about punitive strategies.
We have never had it so good and we have never been so selfish.
Yeah, in lots of ways it's really disappointing because I think that we are better than that, and I think we can be more hospitable. I think the evidence shows that asylum seekers and refugees do contribute to our country in fantastic ways. And so I think in lots of ways it's come down to language and lack of leadership on positive ways to manage the asylum issue, really.
And I think the whole terrorist issue was used very badly back in the Howard days to make us fear these people almost and say, well, they're coming here and they could be terrorists.
Do you know how many boat people have been found to be a terrorist?
Oh, probably about two.
None.
Well, there you go.
One of the challenges is that very, very few people have received adverse security checks, and yet we keep everybody in detention. It's a
and
bit.
And yet, then we look at our military facilities and the terrible lapses of security that they've been, infected with. I don't know whether we're actually doing that good on the security front, anyway.
Well, there's no reason, really, that we can't take a risk-based approach. And really, when you talk about mandatory detention, and neither side of government is going to step away from that in a hurry. We can see that in the dialogue. But technically, mandatory detention doesn't need to mean for the life of the visa. It could be 2 days,
or the life
a week,
of the person.
Or the life of the person in some circumstances, and you're absolutely right. There could be circumstances where that happens. So I think we really need to challenge what we're doing and how we're doing it to create a much better, not only compassionate, but also pragmatic, logical way of managing asylum seekers in this country.
It's sort of like the chicken and the egg, isn't it? The politicians need to change the way they speak to lead the people, but the people also need to change what they're thinking and speaking about.
That's called leadership.
And it's you know, we need to be out there protesting and telling the politicians we're not happy.
Well, the refugees take all of our Centrelink money, don't they, Kaz?
Well, absolutely not. In fact, most people who are living in the community are on less than the rate that an Australian citizen would be. But I think just wanted to pick up your point there that one of the reasons this continues to happen is because we don't have any positive bipartisan principles on this issue. So, family protection, child protection, domestic violence, we don't see this kind of debate on either side of government because there's an understanding that it's not okay to talk about how much harm is too much harm on the basis of government policy. We really need to get some principles where both sides of government agree. We're not going to call people illegals anymore because it's wrong. You know, we're going to look at mandatory detention and look at how we can actually manage it so it's more positive for individuals in our country.
Let's change the language to
Absolutely.
Reflect the situation, the scenario and the issue.
Well, certainly the SBS program, Go Back to Where You Came From, seems to have raised the whole topic again in people's consciousness in a really dynamic way, wasn't it?
It was a fascinating program, and I think really it's done that because it's, I think, really got to the core of the fact that these are human beings we're talking about who have terrible experiences on many occasions. And whether or not someone's found to be a refugee, they could still have been through some awful experiences. And I think what that show really was successful in was humanising the debate.
The ABC recently aired a 20-year perspective on some refugees from Cambodia and showed what a contribution that they had made to this country in that time and their families and their family's family. Then I believe coming up on the ABC 2, there is a documentary on 10 years. It's 10 years, can you believe, since the children overboard scenario. That will be followed by an edition of Q&A, where they will debate this very issue that we're talking about now. How do you see the future and transforming the future of both our country and its people and those that we should be helping and welcoming?
Well, I think, some of the good things about, the conversation around Malaysia and Indonesia is that it is starting to have an impact and starting to help people think more about the fact that we do need to be engaged in our region. We can't just shut the door and say, well, it's not our problem. It's a global problem and we need to begin, I think, to take more seriously engaging in the region. Now, that might mean putting up some more money for investing in civil society, in governments, in other countries to assist them to manage the people who are in their location. And it might mean that we actually want to take more people, but we want to take them from those countries by agreement rather than encouraging people to get on a boat because they're not safe where they are. If we can start to do that, change the language, have that leadership, I think we can begin to move away from what is a very ugly debate.
We've already established that about 1% of those seeking a new home in the world get it.
That's right.
There is, for every 1,000 Australian people, a total of 1.1 refugee in this country. So the ratio hasn't indicated to me that we're being overrun by people from a foreign land. Why do we have it in our heads that this is the case?
Well, in lots of ways, I'd be interested to hear what you think about that. I think, you know, as I mentioned...
If you really heard what I think about this, I'd be off air, but...
we don't have one of those buttons.
No, we don't.
Well, I think this is one of the questions for all of us, you know. What has influenced this nation to have these kinds of conversations? And some of them, I think, is, as we've said, that the lack of leadership over the last successive governments. Some of it, I think, is probably a latent... fear that we managed to invade a country and we're scared that somebody else might do it to us. I think there are a range of things that it's easy to trigger discriminatory thought. And when we have our leaders doing that, this is the result.
I think it's also ignorance. I mean, that program that we talked about on SBS really brought home what conditions these people are living on in when they do escape their own countries, but they're now in camps in Malaysia or in Africa. It's just appalling.
Yeah, the incredibly challenging conditions. And I think, you know, part of our aim would be able to participate in improving those conditions. Those conditions is why people get on a boat to come to Australia.
Exactly.
Malaysia and Indonesia have not signed the Refugee Convention. They're under no obligation to provide care and support or protection there. That's why they move.
And they have a history of human rights abuse.
But, you know, if we can actually engage those regions, I'm not saying it's going to be a perfect, you know, short-term solution, but the more Australia can play a leadership role in the region to encourage and support the increase in human rights context, then that's a great thing for us to do. We might need to show our own leadership by not keeping people in detention for long periods of time, though.
Is there a world's best practice for this type of thing? Is there a country that has it right?
Well, the International Detention Coalition has just come back after 2 years of research going around the world looking at reception models, at detention, community care arrangements. Pardon me, they would probably, I think, say there's not one perfect model, but there's some really good stuff going on out there in different countries and we can learn a lot from it.
Could we send our politicians on a little trip overseas to have a look at these?
Oh, we did last week.
Did they go to any of these places?
The opposition minister for immigration went to Malaysia and came back armed with more rhetoric. Cass Coleman, your relationship with the people that arrive, how does it keep you going? Because you see, I would imagine, some of the most damaged people on the planet.
Well, certainly there's a range of people now who are seeing some pretty awful situations, and I think that's a really good question, because not just for me but for Serco staff, for the department staff, for people who are volunteering or providing services, it's becoming very, very distressing, not only for asylum seekers but for those who work with them. And I think we, you know, really need to take that seriously and look at the damage we're doing across the board, not just to asylum seekers, but really to a whole range of people in Australia.
And the lives we continue to ruin.
Absolutely. And the money it's going to cost to help put them back together. It's not really a logical way of managing the situation.
And all the positive bits that we're missing out on along the way. It's just bizarre.
After that program, I noticed that one of the people actually has got involved with a family, and I thought that was a really positive thing. If people do want to get involved, what can they do?
Well, there's a range of organisations now who provide volunteer services, and particularly with the children and families and unaccompanied minors who've now been relocated in the community. And so I'd suggest as the first option you might like to ring the Australian Red Cross and ask about what volunteering options they've got, because they're, of course, managing that contract.
Don't tell them you're gay, but go on.
It might be all right.
They're getting a little better.
And certainly there'll be opportunities coming up. There's a program that's being worked on at the moment, looking at trying to get more volunteers to take people out of detention on excursions, to try and give them a more normalising and humanising experience. So, but certainly the Australian Red Cross would be a great first option.
And there are Australians who, I guess, take on board a detention centre within their community and actually start to do that welcoming and try and diffuse the sort of us and them that is forced upon us all by having a barbed wire fence.
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, I'm not sure if you noticed, but in the media release that Minister Bowen put out around the children and families, there was also a mention that...
Oh, yes, he was very proud of that.
Well, I'm pretty proud too. there was also a mention that one of the centres in Melbourne is going to consult with the community and look at making it an open centre. Now, that basically means they would pull down the fences and allow people to move freely in the community as long as they reside in that location. So,
wouldn't that be nice?
Oh, that's fabulous.
Wow.
Can we help pull down the fences like they did the wall between, you know, in Germany?
Well, that's a great start.
Yeah.
It is. And I think, you know, that's a model that we might be able to move to see in some places. Other places, that's not going to be possible. Certainly being in the middle of the desert, there won't be much for you to do or go or places to go.
But not much the other side of the fence.
That's right. Some of those urban centres, you know, that's not outside the realm of possibility.
Well, it seems that we were going further and further backwards as a nation surrounded by water. Let's hope that the future is a little bit more rosy for those that are in need of our care and a new place to live. It's come a long way since a dodgy safe house in the suburbs of Bendigo to... an asylum centre in Malaysia. Maybe it hasn't come a long way. Kaz Coleman, keep up the tremendous work that you do. Thank you very much for your insights today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on the program.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.